Race matters.
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 Before we begin, as always, I would like to acknowledge and pay my respects to the lands that we are meeting and gathering on today, and the lands of the Gadigal people. The Gadigal people have been a part of this land and landscape for 60,000 to 80,000 years and time immemorial before us, and they will be here after us as well. They are still here and a part of this beautiful land, and no matter where you go, city or bush, it always was and always will be Aboriginal country and Aboriginal land. And so I'd like to acknowledge and pay my respects to the Gadigal peoples, their elders, both past, present, and any future listeners that we have here listening in with us today. And I am joined in here for Race Matters today by Nayuka Gori. How are you going, Nayuka?
Yeah, I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. Can we get your nations and qualifications? That's how I used like to kick off when we do our First Nations mob. We've got nations, qualifications. Talk yourself up.
Okay. So my mobs are Kanai, Gunitjmara, Wiradjuri, and Yorta Yorta. I'm a writer. Like social commentary sort of stuff. And also a TV writer. I went back to uni this year to study creative writing, which is weird because it's probably a few years too late. But anyway, it's good to learn the craft.
Yeah, I know. You're already killing it in the field.
Studying's weird. But working on a book at the moment. Being mentored by Alison Whittaker through that, which is like sick.
Yeah.
I feel really lucky. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I'm also a lover, friend, daughter, sibling.
Well, thank you so, so much for joining us on the Race Matters platform today. And it really is a massive honor to have your voice contributing to our program, and especially for me, because I've been following your writing since like I was at university as well. And it was a while ago I was at uni, and your writing really kind of navigated and guided me through a lot of perplexed times, a lot of times that I wasn't sure of my place and how to voice my concerns, and your writing really validated that for me. And one of the pieces that really struck a chord with me was the 2016 piece that you wrote, and it really struck a chord with me because I was working in a program at the time that was gaslighting the hell out of me, and it was your piece White Victims and Black Monsters, Why I Have No Time for Becky Feminism. And it really was the first time where I read something that spoke to a problem that a lot of black people face, and that's white women weaponizing their tears. So what led you to write an article around white feminism, and was there any backlash to it?
So to answer your first question, I think what had happened was, as with all of that sort of like youthy media, like junky stuff, like something had happened. It's like there was a pop cultural moment. Lena Dunham had been Lena Dunham. she did something stupid, but it also, it was something I thought about a lot, and had noticed in my own life, and particularly when I started writing, had a lot of people who I thought were friends who got really, were really upset with me about the stuff that I was writing and the position I was taking on stuff, which is weird because I've always had these politics, I guess, you know, whatever. But often it was white women, my like former friends who were white women who, yeah, like employing, like it's for me, I think it's really manipulative behavior. So I feel like it's a kind of manipulation to try and keep people in their place. If that was happening in a relationship, you'd call that behavior emotionally abusive. So yeah, just looking around the world, and particularly when it came to, I think that piece was also about the way that black men are positioned in the white imagination, particularly like, yeah, white women. Yeah. So it was, that stuff still, obviously it's funny, you write stuff, but I never stopped thinking about that. Like even thinking about Castor, I don't know if you've been following that stuff with
No, I saw you posted something about it today, but I haven't followed up on it yet. So, if you could give us a brief outline of what's occurred there.
Yeah. So I'm not across all the details, so I don't want to talk because I'm afraid I'm going to, I don't have all the details. But something that is interesting has been, looking at old footage of white women who were racing against Castor and losing. There was one video in particular. There was this, I think she was a British white lady who came fifth or fourth or whatever, and in her interview after was crying at having lost and how unfair it was that Castor won. But there were two other black people who beat this white woman as well. So it was just interesting that, just the deployment of tears.
Mm.
It's disgusting.
Yeah, and it's because it's very visual. You know, and it's very loud, and it all it's like
stop crying so loudly.
It is. It's you know, it's something that people engage with first before they engage with our voices.
Yeah,
you know, and so it automatically paints a picture that's never going to be in our favor. And I've been in that position many times, and it doesn't matter how much you try to explain yourself or remain calm, even though everything inside you is burning up, we have to ultimately, you know, censor our emotions.
Oh, absolutely. And also, like you mentioned workplaces before, I think that was also another, like, I think I was thinking about that as well. So at the time I was working in the not-for-profit space, and it is full of white women and fragile white women who, like, won't take any accountability for what they do, and instead make it your responsibility to deal with their guilt, or whatever. So I think that was also playing. But I do want to write, I think at one point I'd like to write about that, the not-for-profit sector and the, like, insidious violence of white women in those spaces.
Oh, that would be so good. Can you please do that? It's so necessary.
It's toxic. Mm-hmm. It's, gross. Anyway, we could talk about that all day. You might want to hold my comb when you find out what I made of. You might want to follow me and copy all of my mistakes. I'm so nice, so nice.
Your writing also, like, massively resonates with so many black women, both binary, non-binary and trans, and particularly because you take so much of our rage and our passion and our lived experiences and you formulate it into a single sentence that can, like, really execute the argument and anyone that's opposing it. So how do you get to that place in your writing? Is there a process of your own anger and lived experiences before you get it onto the page?
Yeah, I feel like writing is like an outlet for the cold fury that I have all the time at the world. I feel like I live in a constant state of fury, which probably I think a lot of people do. So it is, I think anger is one of the most useful emotions when it's, like, employed properly or whatever. I think it's really important to be angry. So I guess I see white, whiting. Oh my God, writing. I've been around too many white people. I see writing as like a kind of weaponry. And I see it as like, I see it as it's like tools for people or weapons for people. Or it can also be like comfort or whatever it might be. I think, yeah, definitely the cold fury. And also I feel like sometimes like I'm like sarcastic or really snarky. I think that's important. I don't know. I don't know how. I think definitely when I first started writing, I would write like it wasn't cold. It was hot. It was like very not sexy hot. It was just like a really hot rage. I just wanted, like, if I didn't do it, I would tear my hair out. Mm. Like, I needed a place to be angry. And so I think a lot of my earlier writing was that. But now, like, my writing has changed and it's gotten colder, but it's still furious. I feel like if I'm not passionate, I feel like anger is my motivator. So if I'm not passionate about whatever it is, then I don't know if I can finish, if I can actually finish the thing. Mm. But I think sometimes, and like behind that anger, I was about to say, like, it would be nice to come from a place of love to do something because you love it. But then I realized, actually, I think behind that anger is love, like a love of like people and country. And so actually, like, anger is love. I don't know.
It is. I 110% agree with that statement that like a lot of our anger is coming from a place where we're like, our anger isn't essentially about us. It's always about, you know, for our people, you know? And if we don't say something, we have to put those voices out there for our people. And so that the younger mob as well can listen to what's being said, because there's so much horrible content out there and policies and actions on the streets and everything, and the way that we live and how we're housed and our health, everything, and how we're policed, you know, and just in the schools as well, that if, you know, we're not being angry about it, then we have, it's a form of loving ourselves and loving our mob.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It is that. I think also, I think particularly black women, probably all women actually, but not all women. I think especially for black women, there is no space for our anger. There is nowhere to put it. I just feel like we have to be so stitched up all the time and have to be like, kind of not lose it because of where we exist in the white imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, yeah, I don't know. Writing can be really logical, but it's also like quite a passionate thing as well.
Yeah, and it's like you said before, it's a weapon for our own kind of outlet for when we do go through those experiences, like in non-for-profit orgs. Like what got me through a lot of those times was my own writing too.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, or listening to other writers, you know. I think listening to other black writers and their own process is definitely very kind of calming in your own experiences, which leads me to this part here about your piece, which I loved. Protests such as Don't Kill Live Music seem to represent white self-interest. And that's because I wrote the very similar thing just as a status on Facebook. So then when I saw that you had written a whole article on it on The Guardian, I was just like, well, that's the best validation I could ever get. And if anyone wants to disagree with me, then you can just read this and go and tell Nayuka. But
I'm mad about it.
Yeah. But one of the sentences in it that really sent it home was, white men want police to not charge them money for their festivals while we are asking to not be killed by them. So how do you describe to people who are not of colour and are not affected by white colonial systems that their self-interest actually do exclude black people?
I mean, well, I try to write about it, but I think that piece made a lot of people angry.
Yeah.
I didn't really see a lot of that anger. Like, no one got in touch with me. Actually, some PhD student got in touch and was like, where did you get this statistic from? And I was like, oh. Like, well, I did. So then I had to send him like the research that I read to write that. Anyway, it's funny how people like that. I think sometimes it feels like a lot of writing is like proof of your humanity. It's just like, can you see that I am a human? I feel like sometimes a lot of writing can be like that. And I feel like that piece is one of those, like, look at these other humans that you're not. Anyway,
yeah.
You know what was funny as well, now that I think about it? So I wrote that, and not long after, the New South Wales elections were happening. And I noticed that the organisation that I think I might have dragged in that piece put up preference the Sustainable Australia Party, right? I was like, isn't that interesting that they're, like, supportive of this white supremacist group? And, like, I don't know. Yeah, just find it very interesting.
I saw that too. Yeah. It really was, like, a confirmation of what, like, exactly. Our own... And I feel like, as black people, most of our instincts are always right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
I have them happen all the time, and sometimes I'm like, am I crazy? And, like, am I, like, you know, overthinking it? Am I too involved in this? Am I being biased? And then something happens, and I'm like, I knew it. I'm always right. Always black people, always right.
But I don't know, like, if that'll result in any kind of behavioural change. I've been thinking, I don't know, it's a big philosophical question, like, does writing change the world or whatever? I'm not going to go into that today, but, it's for those people, like, they should be so lucky that they get someone to walk through why what they did was wrong, and, like, they also can do the work to be better. Go and do that work. Don't cry about it in your group chat. I know that happened.
Yeah. And it's really infuriating when they come to us for answers as well. You know, like, oh, well, then what can we do to make things better? And I'm like, okay, well, if you're going to show up to those rallies, why don't you show up to our rallies?
But also, like, this is the thing. I agree with their, like, we're actually on the same side. But, like, you need to broaden the scope or, like, zoom out a bit, because right now you're only interested, like, you're only protecting the interests of white people.
Mm.
Like, that's a problem.
Yeah.
And that's not my problem. Like, and that's not, like, your problem. It's their problem.
Mm.
Like, just do the work. It actually isn't hard. You just need to, be able to see that, like, if black people, like, aren't we people too? Like, anyway.
Yeah.
Yada yada. I don't want to talk about them.
Well,
I'm glad, but I'm really glad, because I was writing from Melbourne, and what I am glad is that people, and particularly, like, mob and people of colour up here, like, agreed with that as well, because I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm stepping on toes here, but this is just what it looks like from where I live, and living in a place like Melbourne. So I'm glad it was...
It did. A lot of black people here very much felt the exact same way, especially, like, because I work near where the protest was happening, so I was walking past it all, and there was very, like, there was no mob there, you know, especially because the protest happened right after Invasion Day rallies as well. So it was just, like, you can just feel the vibe, and the reason for why people were showing up was just not the same, and it just was... Yeah, all it felt like was your article. It was representing all white self-interest.
It's like, I'm not saying as well that people can't care about many things. Like, that wasn't what I was saying. Like, I think, like, by all means have that rally, but just, like, the scope of it is so white and narrow. Like, that's what I had a problem with. The inability to see how issues are related. Like, if you're going to go after, like, cops or the state and not include black people in that, like, you're not looking at it properly.
And then put a noose on your protest signs as well.
Like, come on. How?
Yeah.
I mean...
Tone deaf.
And just dramatic. Just so dramatic.
Yeah.
I was... Yeah. Like, okay, this is disgusting imagery.
Mm.
Like, get it together.
Yeah. Do you have a self-care practice for dealing with these racist institutions and fake allies? Do you have, like, your own way of taking care of yourself?
Healthy self-care. I like to, now that I'm back at uni as well, I like to not be online. I'm really thinking about, like, getting off Facebook and getting off like Instagram would be really hard and Twitter. I don't know. I think that's important. I think it's important to, I know that the internet is really important to a lot of people and it is for me, but like, I think it's kind of forget how to live in the real world. Yeah. So I think that's a big part of it, getting offline. And like on any given day, at any given time, there is an injustice happening in this country. There's cops like storming into a black house. There are kids being taken from their families. There's so much to be angry about. But you can't be useful if you're burnt out and if you're whatever. So I try to, yeah, I try to, all I ever want to do is be useful. So it's, yeah, I try to log off and I have a puppy, Ned. I love her so much. I go hiking a little bit and also have like really solid group of like family and friends. And I spend as much time as I can around mob because I actually think that's the most important thing that we can do. I think, yeah, I think particularly like writing, I don't know. I think to answer your question, I think it's also about not being distrustful, but trying to understand the motives of people who, like, I feel like there's a lot of people who like to collect people. Have you watched Harry Potter or read Harry Potter?
Yeah.
So you know the Slug Club?
Yeah.
So I feel like there are people who have their own little versions of slug clubs. Mm-hmm. Like older white women often do that, like their little coloureds or something. Yeah. So yeah.
Or they're knitting for Africa.
Yeah. Like I think it's, so I try to not join anyone's slug club and just be cautious of people. And also like, black women are just amazing. So
yeah.
Being around black women, yeah, it's really important. And I watched a lot of Grace and Frankie last year. I watched it like 5 or 6 times in a row. It's like a 5-season, 4-season show.
Is that the one with
those two old white
Jane
ladies?
Fonda?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's keeping it tight.
keeping it tight.
She's keeping it tight. Oh, she looks great. Good for her.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like, yeah, watching television and, yeah, been reading a lot more this year as well. The other thing as well is we can always say no.
That's a big thing. I think that's a really great point to raise as well because, yeah, we're always, there's a, not a guilt, but, you know, there's this constant feeling that everything that we do, we're not always inherently doing it for ourselves. There's a bigger reason for why we do things, and sometimes it's not in our best interest.
Yeah. Like, is it worth the drama? Is it worth, you know, it's going to be, yeah, sure, you might get like $200, $500, grand, whatever it is, but like, how much is it going to cost emotionally to do that thing? Yeah. And also, I would also say, like, don't, unless it's like you're really passionate about it or it's for like mob or whatever, don't do stuff for free for white people is like another thing as well.
That's a big thing that a lot of our young listeners should be wary of too, because it's starting to be a bigger conversation around it now, or from what I can kind of see from my own circles, is getting that word out there about knowing how much you should be paid and saying that, you know, like, don't take some sort of fee from a white organization and then find, and then you end up finding out later on down the track that everyone else got paid at a bigger rate and you got paid a poxy charity rate.
Exactly. So I recently got an agent, which has been really good, like someone to deal with the admin-y side of things, because I'm really bad at it, as you probably are aware now. but I didn't realize, like, you know, I would previously, where I'd be getting like a couple of $100, Like, she's told me, no, the standard fee for something like, you know, that sort of stuff is a couple of $1,000s. Like, I just, and I'm like, looking back, I'm like, how many times, like, what work have I done? I mean, who cares? Money, whatever, but we all have to pay rent on stolen land. It's weird. yeah, just not, I didn't know my value or whatever. I mean, obviously, human beings are priceless, but yeah, it's, I think knowing your worth and just saying no, like have boundaries around who you let into your interior, I think. Yeah.
So before we get into one of our last questions, my favorite question, my last, the second one, last one is for all of our younger mob who are learning about their emotions and their identity, how to belong and how to find strength in all of it. What would be your advice to them?
I think like go find your people, just find your people, be with your people, whatever, whoever those people are. Also, this is a weird one, but I think reading, if like if that's your jam, I think, yeah, there's, and like reading people who've died and like, or reading people who just like read back, I think, throughout history, I think, yeah, we have, there is so much good, particularly like black writing that already exists, like it's not a new phenomenon or whatever. I think I do feel like we're having some kind of renaissance-y kind of vibe at the moment. But yeah, just at the moment reading, do you know the poet Lisa Ballier? Her last name is B-E-L-L-E-A-R. So I don't know.
No, I don't.
where she's a queer poet and photographer from Melbourne, blackfella. Just, yeah, reading her like a collection that's posthumous collection, I think they're called. And it's like, oh, this like queer black woman was writing about the same stuff that, yeah, just find, yeah, anyway.
Find the content.
Find,
there's
yeah.
so much content though. Like, you know, that's what makes me angry when I see it, when people say, you know, like, oh, we can't find the right, we don't, you know, to teach this area, we don't have the content, we don't have the writers, we don't have the black expertise on it. It's like there's so much.
Yeah, there really is. Also, put back to your question, particularly for people who use Instagram, something I would recommend is like curate a feed that is the world that you want to live in. I think that's the, like, if you want to see bodies that, you know, have a feed that has diversity of bodies and, yeah, I think that's the biggest thing, because there's so much whiteness in the world. And I think try to just create the blackest world that you can.
Deserve.
when did you realize that your race made you powerful?
I think the first time, I've always been proud of being black. And I didn't know anything else until I would have gone to school, because both my parents were black and all my family are black. So I didn't know, wasn't aware of white until primary school, really. Me and my cousin Jerry started school together year one, and we went to the same school and we were in the same class. It was really cute. And we, as part of that class, we did a play, and it was this medieval play, and there were props that we'd made, like really badly drawn, like props of a castle pinned onto a like cushiony board thing. And there's a photo of me and Jerry standing in front of props that we'd made, and in the castle I'd drawn an Aboriginal flag on the pole. I was like five. Yeah, I would have been five at the time. So I think, like, that seems to me to be something like quite a powerful, subversive thing for a five-year-old to do in that space. So I think that would probably be the when I must have felt something. I don't remember what I felt, but I must have. Yeah. Another time I think would have been year six or year seven. Yeah.
That's really great answer. That's something really different to what we've had as well. And yeah, it really does speak to how you view yourself as a child as well, and how much like our identity as blackfellas and our culture is, you know, it's not something that, you know, we realize later on in life. It's something that we're born with. It's our lived experiences. It's our kinship. It's our mob. It's who we see around us day in and day out, you know. So that was really, really nice. And I really thank you for coming on to Race Matters.
Thank you.
Sharing your yarns with us and sharing your dialogue and your words with us. It really means a lot, especially to have a black writer on here too. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Race Matters.
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 Race Matters. Race Matters.